I do not believe the greatest threat to our future is from bombs or guided missiles. I don't think our civilization will die that way. I think it will die when we no longer care, when the spiritual forces that make us wish to be right and noble die in the hearts of men. Arnold Toynbee has pointed out that 19 of 21 civilizations have died from within and not by conquest from without. There were no bands playing and no flags waving when these civilizations decayed. It happened slowly, in the quiet and the dark, when no one was aware.
Second Sunday. Pollution. How dangerous.
Good evening. This is Bill Lindsay, NBC News. 24 years ago, American scientists made their first atom bomb, and they expressed their fears for the survival of mankind. Today, they have again expressed similar fears, but for a different reason. This was expressed in the eloquent warning by Dr. Lawrence Gould, former president of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. The world is rapidly becoming overcrowded, and there are many complex, if not lethal, problems created by our manner of living. The word pollution is an everyday word now, but there are new forms of pollution combining with old ones that are threatening our survival. There is a world biological crisis. Nations are disturbed over the question, pollution, how dangerous?
Mr. President, the General Assembly is now beginning a debate on a matter which it seems to the Swedish government is of direct and critical concern to all peoples on Earth. Man has always had to struggle to force a living out of an often hostile natural environment, thereby changing it and undergoing changes himself. Every civilization has indeed been built on and conditioned by the way the natural resources were utilized. We also know that whole civilizations disappeared as a result of mismanagement and misuse of natural resources.
The Swedish ambassador, Sverker Ostrom, in his hour-long statement last December, carefully explained why the United Nations should adopt his country's resolution. It called for a world conference on the environment. It was supported by more than 40 underdeveloped or developing nations who were afraid that pollution problems would be exported to their countries. The pollution problems that face Sweden and the developing nations have faced the United States for years. But in the past, only a few of us were concerned about the long-range consequences. To most Americans, factory smoke meant dollars in their pockets. Scientists who made warnings, like that of Ambassador Ostrom, were called alarmists. Dr. Harrison Brown is a renowned geological chemist and professor of science and government at the California Institute of Technology. Harrison Brown has measured the life support system of this planet in terms of space, food, steel, coal, sand gravel, and other resources that are needed to support every person on this earth.
We have viewed our atmosphere as being a sink into which we can throw everything without having repercussions. We now recognize that that our atmosphere is limited from this point of view. We have viewed our rivers as being infinite in size, having infinite capacity to take our trash and our garbage. We now know that that is not true. We have viewed our oceans as being of infinite size, and we now know that that is not true. I think we've got to recognize, gradually we're learning, that in a sense, our planet is like a spaceship going around the sun, and that we have a life support system, and that life support system consists of our atmosphere, our ocean. They're interacting with each other. And we've got to learn to treat that life support system properly.
I think the significance of the pollution problem is that it constitutes a threat to the survival of man. We sometimes think of pollution as a kind of a smelly nuisance, something that makes the eyes smart and so on. But it's really much more than that. The changes that pollution represents in the environment are destroying, I think, the capability of the environment to support human beings, and for that matter, most forms of life. We live in a thin film on the surface of the earth, the soil, the water, and the air. And we have to have the air, water, and soil in order to survive. We have to breathe air that has oxygen in it. We have to drink water. We need water for our industries. We need the soil in proper condition to grow crops. What's been happening with pollution is that the new technological developments that we've begun to use have changed the environment in such a way as to threaten the stability of the biological systems that make up the environment.
These were the warnings of the Swedish ambassador to the United Nations and of leading American scientists, the latter, biologist Barry Commoner, author of Science and Survival. To believe the seriousness of their statements, one should examine the evidence. Professor Barry Commoner is the director of Washington University's Center for the Biology of Natural Systems. He is concerned about the death of Lake Erie, the 200 million gallons of raw sewage dumped into the Hudson River every day, the serious pollution of the once princely Rhine River, the oceans, too, which are becoming polluted, and a very serious water pollution problem that he says will hit this country around 1980.
Well, now we have enough information to be able to calculate the growing amount of organic waste that is imposed on our surface waters. We can also calculate from experimental data the amount of oxygen that's available in the rivers and lakes of the United States to accommodate organic waste. And what we now know is that the amount of organic waste being put into rivers and lakes is increasing, and that its demand for oxygen will equal the total oxygen available in our surface waters somewhere around 1980. In other words, we're heading for a kind of crunch between the waste that we're putting into our waters and the ability, as expressed through the available oxygen, of these waters to accommodate that waste. And somewhere around 1980, we are going to be producing enough waste to break down the capability of surface waters to purify that waste, and organic matter will begin to accumulate in our surface waters. This means that they're going to be pretty smelly, not very good for industrial use or domestic use, and we will have a very serious water pollution problem on the average throughout the country at that point, because we will have used up the self-purifying capacity of our water systems. Now, of course, this will be worse in some places and better in others, but this is an average figure which shows how serious the problem is throughout the country.
American farmers use nitrogen fertilizers extensively. The fertilizers are cheap and produce profitable returns. However, little has been said that the fertilizers have caused about 50% of our water pollution problem. It is industry and municipal sewage that still get most or all of the blame. But the nitrogen fertilizers get down to the groundwater and wash into the rivers, where it promotes the growth of algae. The algae die, and the organic matter they contain pollutes the surface water. It was recently reported that almost every river in Illinois has reached this eutrophic condition. This is one of the pollution problems the developing countries wish to avoid, despite the benefits of technology. From a health standpoint, it's even more serious, because there might be nitrite poisoning, and blue babies can result if their food and water contains too much nitrate. Dr. Commoner says that well water in a good deal of the Central Valley of Southern California has reached levels of nitrate from fertilizers that exceed the limits proposed by public health officials. Nitrate is not very harmful in itself, but it can be converted into toxic nitrite by bacteria in the intestine. Dr. Commoner explains.
Nitrite is poisonous because it combines with the hemoglobin in the blood and prevents the blood from carrying oxygen. This is a particular problem in infants. An infant that has diarrhea may have bacteria moving from its intestine into the upper part of its intestinal tract, and there it can come in contact with nitrate that might be in drinking water or in the baby's formula. And as a result, the bacteria convert nitrate to nitrite. The nitrite combines with the blood, and you have a blue baby, which has to be treated right away in order to save it from asphyxiation. This problem has already arisen as a result of feeding infants on formulas made from well water that contains too much nitrate. Then in some parts of California, pediatricians have recommended to mothers that they use bottled water instead of well water. Another feature of this problem is that when plants are grown on excessive levels of fertilizer, they may contain enough nitrate in them to cause trouble when fed to infants. This problem has not yet arisen medically in the United States, but in North Germany, a number of cases have been reported by pediatricians of nitrite poisoning, which results from feeding children spinach particularly, which often contains too much nitrate. Analyses of baby foods in this country and Canada show that the levels of nitrate that occur in these baby foods may sometimes get as high as those reported in Germany as causing difficulty. And again, this is a problem that we need to look at very carefully because it is likely to get worse if we don't watch the way in which we use nitrogen fertilizer.
At the Thanksgiving weekend in 1966, the level had risen beyond emergency, and Mayor Lindsay asked everyone to leave Manhattan Island. Fortunately, it was the Thanksgiving weekend, and most of the people had gone away. Even so, 500 or 600 deaths occurred from the smog that settled down into the canyon-like streets of that city. And it's estimated that if there had been no holiday, perhaps as many as 10,000 would have died.
Dr. Gould points out that every day, chimneys in the United States pour 100,000 tons of sulfur dioxide into the air. Motor vehicles add 230,000 tons of carbon monoxide. This air pollution is known too well by city dwellers who suffer rising rates of lung diseases. But now modern technology has added new hazards to the air people breathe. Tiny particles of asbestos from building materials and bits of glass wool from air conditioning systems that find their way into human lungs. And then there is the question of how much lead is natural in the modern environment. 5 years ago, American scientist Claire Patterson, who is well known for measuring the age of the Earth with lead isotope tracers, began a series of expeditions to Greenland and Antarctica. There he tunneled hundreds of feet through layers of virginal snows, measuring the industrial lead contamination deposited there by the wind over hundreds of years. Industrial lead from the world's smelters and car exhausts.
We calculate that about 100 times more lead is in our bodies than were in our prehistoric ancestors. I'm an avid foe of lead pollution, and in this regard I'm also therefore on the other side of the fence from lead industries. We are opponents and we're antagonists. For example, I feel that children living in urban areas near freeways, for example, just to take this case, are being irreparably damaged. Their nervous systems and their bodies are being irreparably damaged from the fumes coming, the lead in the fumes coming from automobile exhaust.
What are the effects of lead concentration on the human body? What does it do?
Well, the concentration of lead in the typical American today is about 2/10 of a part per million. That means out of a million parts of a man's blood, 2/10 of those million parts is lead. Now, the concentration, it has been observed experimentally, the concentration of lead in a person's blood changes. It increases as the input of lead increases. As you take food that's contaminated with lead, the lead level of your blood goes up. And then a lot of this, now the lead enters the body from the intestine. It goes through what's called the portal blood system. It goes through the liver, and then it goes throughout the whole body. Most of the lead is excreted in the feces, but part of the lead that gets through the intestinal wall and into the body and into the blood, part of that is stored in the bones and part is excreted in the urine. Now, as I say, we today, the average person, has about 2/10 of a part per million of lead in our blood. I think, as a geochemist, in looking at the trace metals, the other trace metals in the biosphere, in soils and plants and animals and so on, and comparing those with lead, I believe that we should have about 1% of that amount of lead in our bodies.
The U.S. Public Health Service claims that Norway, with low air pollution, has half the lung cancer of the United States. But does this mean that air pollution is a direct cause of lung cancer? This debate came up during a surgical operation in a Chicago hospital recently. The patient, a young medical student, was undergoing a mediastinoscopy, the relatively new diagnostic procedure for lung cancer. The surgery is considered minor, and in no way was the patient's life endangered during the debate between the lady anesthesiologist and the non-operating doctor spokesman.
In the incidence of respiratory diseases in New York City, now it's true you can make the same correlation with drinking pop. There may be the same increased incidence. But people who are working with the disease, it seems to me that although it isn't foolproof yet, believe that one of the causes for increased incidence of bronchitis and general resistance to infectious diseases, in other words, a patient has an infectious lung disease. If their lungs were healthy, they might be up and around in a few days. Because the lungs are less healthy because of air pollution, that person may end up in the hospital with a chronic respiratory disease. Now, I feel that there's a correlation indirectly this way.
Well, I can't but agree with you.
Which means that air pollution is very important in lung diseases, even though there is no established connection between cause of a specific disease.
Well, we'd have to say even more than lung diseases, because since the body defenses requires adequate oxygen content to the entire, all the tissues, then one might even say the same about other diseases outside of the chest, that the resistance to these diseases would be decreased by poor lungs.
Right. I just appreciate bringing up this part because I feel that air pollution is a strong subject that most people are very easy not to pay attention to. It's very easy to get up and go to work and pretend that the health of the nation is not suffering from air pollution. And I didn't want the fact that there isn't a direct cause effect to let people think, well, we don't have to worry about air pollution. I think it's important that as part of this discussion, since we've discussed air pollution, that we include the fact that it's terribly important in a health mechanism. It's very important as a health mechanism in terms of general resistance to disease.
You see, one of the things that should be mentioned here, although we're taking all the precautions of sterility, is we generally do not try to talk during an operation. We try to make, because there's all sorts of questions. There are all sorts of questions of memory, to the patient related to the consideration of the problem of sterility. I'd like to say that as we're getting the rest of these nodes out, it appears to be more and more like sarcoidosis, an early sarcoidosis.
And sarcoidosis is non-cancer, is that right?
That's right.
Just 2 years ago, we found DDT in penguins and seals in Antarctica. We know that must have come from thousands and thousands of miles away because none of it has ever been used anywhere near Antarctica. We know it must have come by water because we have been unable to find any traces of it in the snows that cover that vast continent.
Dr. Gould's warning on DDT was echoed by Ambassador Ostrom in his argument that the United Nations must hold a world conference on the environment. Ambassador Ostrom pointed to the ecological disturbances brought about by man. These can lead to, and have led to, he said, extinction of whole species of fish and other marine organisms, thereby causing severe strains on the food situation in the world. DDT, he said, poses a direct threat to the life of oceanic plankton and algae, for which global oxygen depends largely. And he added, DDT can be detected in the body fat and nervous tissues of all living beings, including man. The short-term benefit but long-term problem of pesticide pollution was discussed by three young scientists associated with Professor Commoner's work in St. Louis.
You say that the cotton that's grown in the United States is not native to here.
No, it isn't. No.
Where is it from?
It is also native to the Middle East, yes.
I see. So then the boll weevil isn't native to the United States.
The boll weevil came in through Mexico. In around 1898, I think, something like that.
I see. So if you stopped growing cotton for 1 year or for 2 years, the boll weevil would not have any other plant that it could eat,
no,
and
it wouldn't die. That's right. That would probably solve the major insect problem in southern cotton.
How do you think the money spent on pesticides compares to, say, 1 year's crop? If you skipped 1 year out of five, would that be more expensive than the present spraying of chemicals to control the boll weevil?
That's very difficult to answer, but when you consider that the entire pesticide business in this country runs to about $2 billion a year, I would say that it would probably be very close.
And the biggest use of pesticides is on this cotton in the South.
Two-thirds of all the pesticides used in North America are used on southern cotton, yes.
That's almost $1.5 billion, isn't it?
Yes.
How important is the cotton that's grown in the South?
From a standpoint of manufacturing cotton fabrics, it's not important at all. Most of it is purchased by the government. Stored in warehouses, and then eventually shipped to overseas countries.
Do you have any idea how much the value of this cotton is annually?
No, I really haven't.
But you mean this is just not very good cotton at all?
It's a very poor quality cotton that fabric makers in this country just refuse to use. You know, they use it for, some of it is used for stuffing mattresses and making very, very rough kinds of fabric, but not much of it.
So this huge global pollution problem stems from the spraying of poisonous chemicals on useless cotton.
That's what it amounts to, yes.
It's really fantastic.
One of the young scientists at Dr. Commoner's Environmental Center in St. Louis is 27-year-old Sheldon Novick. He has written a book, Careless Atom, which was published a few days ago by the same company that put out the late Rachel Carson's book, Silent Spring, in 1963. Like Miss Carson, when she warned of the indiscriminate use of chemical sprays, Novick also believes that the public should know what is happening in the expanding nuclear power industry. He is concerned with the problem of safety and cites examples of mishaps, problems of insurance, radiation damage, and a new pollution problem, radioactive waste, all from nuclear power reactors in this country. It is reactors like these we intend to export to the developing nations. Novick claims that many within the Atomic Energy Commission share his concern.
I wouldn't say that I had more information than the Atomic Energy Commission. I certainly don't. Most of the information I have, I think, probably comes from them and from their publications. I am more concerned than many of them seem to be, and I can't even guess as to why they are officially not as concerned as I should think they would be. I know that many individuals within the commission and on its staff and in its various advisory bodies are as concerned as I, and they've expressed these views in private. It would be good if some of them would express their views in public.
It is doubtful that any one of the pollutants we've talked about is actually a killer at their present levels. Federal laws do guard their permissible limits. However, scientists are continually warning that we are producing a new strain upon biological life, that we must think about the total and not just the parts. for no one actually knows the effects of all the pollutants combined from air, water, soil, lead, radiation, and thermal pollution. There is also noise pollution, which presents both emotional and physical problems. If there is an experiment unlocking this question, it may be going on now in man himself, for probably he is the guinea pig himself, but doesn't know it. To probe the total effects of pollutants, we turned to a distinguished professor of environmental medicine at Mount Sinai School of Medicine of New York University, Dr. Irving Selikoff.
The question has been raised, and I think justifiably, that there may be a very important potential problem with such things as widespread low-level radiation or the widespread contamination of air and soil with lead. It's justifiable, absolutely so, to point to these potential problems rather than wait for their description in terms of human disease, which may not come about for many years. Now, some people will say that we have no knowledge that there actually will be such disease effects. That's true. But I don't think we can take the chance, and therefore control of such potential hazards is justifiable. I have another reason for suggesting such control, and that is that we are beginning to understand that there may be an additive effect of many different substances. In other words, the total body burden of environmental contaminants may be important. There may not be enough lead in itself to cause difficulty. There may not be enough benzpyrene from coal soot to be a problem. There may not be enough carbon monoxide to in itself be a problem from automobile exhaust. There may not be enough radiation exposure to in itself be a problem. But the sum of all these, the total body burden of these environmental hazards, may be significant, and indeed we may eventually see diseases that we don't even begin to understand at this time, and two, the sum total result of these various low-level contaminants, each in itself not very important, may be to generally shorten life. And this is something that we are beginning to study at this time.
What are we in the United States doing about the total effects of all pollutions on living things, especially humans? There is much being done, and yet there is very little being done. It depends on the way you look at the amount of money and labor that are being spent on research and legislation. Government bureaucracy has prevented one single agency from having total responsibility over water, air, land, radiation, thermal, noise, and pesticide pollution. Instead, the recent Air Quality Act, once its regional standards are approved, will be enforced by the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare. The recently approved regional standards of the Water Quality Act are being enforced by the Department of Interior. If there were any standards nationwide for radioactive waste, then by the Atomic Energy Commission. Last Thursday in the Congress, Senator Frank Moss of Utah reintroduced his bill to bring the scattered agencies that guard the nation's land and water resources under a single boss, a cabinet secretary running a single department of natural resources. Senator Moss says that unless there is a single executive department, there cannot be full coordination of the presently fragmented agencies that guard the nation's health and its resources. Senator Edmund Muskie is also holding hearings on his proposal to form a Select Senate Committee on Technology and the Human Environment. This would be a study committee only, not a legislative body. It would bring scientists into the Congress for the first time as consultants only, not as lawmakers. In Washington, one might say, as a gag, there is concern over pollution, but it is not coordinated. The same fear of Big Brother regulating the use of low-cost nitrogen fertilizers on the farms is also found in the case of controversial pesticides. However, a close check is kept on the manufacture of pesticides through an effective system of guidelines, as explained to NBC reporter Russ Ward by a leading Agriculture Department expert on pollution, Kenneth Walker.
Mr. Walker, you say these guidelines are effective, and yet last April, an Arizona dairy cooperative took out a full-page newspaper ad protesting what it called the uncontrolled use of DDT because of the losses it was suffering in terms of milk that simply didn't pass federal standards. There's been the American Beekeeping Foundation complained to the Agriculture Department last year that it was suffering losses. There have been complaints made by salmon hatcheries in the state of Michigan complaining about pesticides being carried through the waterways and creating losses. If we have effective guidelines, how do we account for the complaints that come into the Agriculture Department?
The guidelines that I referred to just a moment ago are registration guidelines. They are guidelines that require certain information be furnished to prove that the material is safe and effective when used as directed. The federal government does not regulate the use of the material in the sense that they tell the farmer, the homeowner, whoever is using the material, that you must or you must not do something.
It's a user violation rather than a manufacturing violation, is that correct?
Yes, violation may be a little strong. In the case of the dairy incident that you mentioned, some of this, we believe, was due to drift when the material was applied, say, by aircraft. The particle size is very small, this material is very light, and it carries quite a distance.
This is what I mean when I say mankind is on a collision course with disaster. I don't see any prospect that in the next few years we are going to bring into balance the population with the food resources of the Earth. We forget that we live on planet Earth, which is limited. There's only a limited quantity of air, a limited quantity of water, a limited quantity of soil. The air you and I are breathing right now is the air that Socrates and Darwin and all others have breathed before us. The water you drank in your coffee this morning may have been the water that flowed down the Delaware when Hudson crossed it. You see, from the beginning of time, there has been a recycling. Creatures that lived before us produced wastes, including their own corpses. These were degraded or decayed biologically by nature and reused by other forms of life. This is what I mean now when I say man is the dirtiest creature ever to inhabit the earth, because he is the first creature that has and continues to produce wastes which are not destroyed, which are not recycled. The glass bottle, the aluminum beer tin are practically indestructible. They'll last as long as the Parthenon or the Pyramid.
The director of the Population Center at the University of Chicago, Philip Hauser, says nothing indicates that population can be slowed down in its race with economic development in Asia, Latin America, and Africa, where developing nations contain two-thirds of the total population of the world. But Professor Hauser points out that present rates of world population growth could not possibly have been sustained over any long period in the past, nor could they persist for very long into the future.
Since present rates of world population growth cannot possibly persist, it is clear that we will have population control. The only question is whether the control will be that imposed by nature or by man. And if by man, whether the control will be rational and relatively defensible or completely irrational and indefensible. If the control is imposed by nature, nature would use, of course, the weapons of famine and pestilence, as discussed by Malthus. If the control comes through man, the irrational and indefensible methods could include war, which, incidentally, with the hydrogen bomb, for the first time offers the possibility of population control. Up until the hydrogen bomb, the military were really quite inept and inefficient and ineffective in controlling population growth. But the hydrogen bomb does hold forth some prospect for control. A second irrational and indefensible method, in my judgment, would, of course, be homosexuality, which studies show is never accompanied by a very high birth rate. And the third, which has much to commend it because of its beautiful symmetry, is cannibalism. Because under this method, the population would go down as the food supply increased. And various points of equilibrium could be decided upon depending on various factors involved. Now, obviously, I'm not advocating these methods, but I am serious in calling attention to the fact that they are not beyond the realm of possibility if more rational and desirable methods are not effective.
Ambassador Ostrom warned the UN General Assembly that all efforts should be encouraged to reduce or to eliminate the harmful side effects of large-scale application of modern technology. One of the primary purposes of the World Conference on the Environment, he said, should be to enable the developing countries to avoid making the same ecological mistakes. One good example is the high dam at Aswan in Egypt, which was designed to produce power and to store up water in Lake Nasser to supply irrigation canals. As the new lake fills up, it is clear to biologists that water hyacinths are evaporating much of the water that enters Lake Nasser each year. The Egyptian government is considering introducing a 300-pound sea cow, manatee, to the lake to destroy the hyacinths. But not enough progress has been made on the animal's husbandry. Another serious problem of Lake Nasser is the disastrous spread of the disease schistosomiasis. It is reported that nearly all of the people living in the irrigated regions have this debilitating disease, which is spread by snails in the irrigation water. The water is used by people for drinking and for discharging their human wastes, which contain the parasitic eggs. The only medication is toxic to humans.
Mr. President, let me sum up. Man depends for his survival on an infinitely complex system of relationships and balances between innumerable living organisms, all existing in or on the extremely thin crust of the earth or just above it. The system has a remarkable capacity for adaptation and regeneration. But nature's patience has a limit. Indiscriminate and uncontrolled use of modern technology, indispensable as such technology is for economic and social progress, may set trends in motion which lead to unforeseen harmful effects in unexpected places. Many of these effects are irreversible. Even if we avoid the risk of blowing up the planet, we may, by changing its face, unwittingly be parties to a process with the same fatal outcome. It seems, therefore, that a broad consideration of the environmental problems and of possible approaches to their solution is of equal interest to all peoples on Earth. United Nations provides a unique forum for such consideration. Mr. President, there are many issues on which the members of the United Nations are divided, and deeply divided. On the issue now before the General Assembly, we are hopefully all united. It is ultimately a question of collective self-preservation. I thank you, Mr. President.
The resolution for a World Conference on the Environment was passed by the General Assembly unanimously, after other statements were heard from Nigeria, Pakistan, Canada, and Romania. More than 50 nations had drafted the resolution. The conference will be held in 1972, the first calendar opening, permitting the nations sufficient time to assemble their scientific thinking. The conference can find solutions to the pollution problem if the nations work out the difficult economics of coming to terms with nature. They must. As Rachel Carson has said with taste, sensitivity, and imagination, man is a part of nature, and his war against nature is inevitably a war against himself. Last November, a group of concerned citizens met together one evening in a lecture hall at the University of Chicago campus. They were the local chapter of the American Meteorological Society, and their guest speaker was Laura Fermi, an elderly, brilliant lady, a distinguished author, and the widow of the atomic pioneer Enrico Fermi.
I'm here as a member of the Cleaner Air Committee of Hyde Park and Kenwood, just to give an example. Oh, I see a member of our committee down there, Mrs. Ann White. So now I'll, if I say something wrong, there'll be a check on me. To tell you a little what a group of citizens can do. The Cleaner Air Committee organized in the spring of 1959 was organized by a group of housewives who were concerned about dirt. Looking in retrospect, the main feature seems to me what our ignorance was at that time. Our motivation was simply dirt and the frustration of having to fight a losing battle against dirt every day. Of the health hazards of air pollution, we knew only the one that got us tired. We were always tired because we had so much cleaning to do. When we went to Alderman Dupre to ask what could be done, we were very surprised to find that there was a Department of Air Pollution Control, that to him dirt was not dirt but air pollution, and that an ordinance had just been passed and was going to go into effect within, I think, 1 month of the time we were talking to him. And he said, you should help the department in getting the ordinance enforced. So, feeling so ignorant, we went around and sought information. We visited the Department of Air Pollution Control, the Armor Research that was doing the measurements of dust fall all over the city. We talked with people from coal and oil firms, with building managers, doctors, and the head of the local janitors' union.
Chicago air probably would be a lot filthier than it is today had Mrs. Fermi's group not taken their stand 10 years ago. But it still is reported to be the second dirtiest in the country. The sulfurous, noxious air, along with other reasons, made Dr. Henry Collins, a university lecturer, flee Chicago with his wife and 8 children to Sydney, Australia, just 1 month ago.
Macquarie University, on the outskirts of Sydney, Australia, is so new they're still building it. It's rising against a background of fields and gum trees. There's fresh air to spare. The birds sing. Doctor, why did you leave Chicago?
For one thing, you could mention the blanket of air pollution that is especially bad in the fall and in the spring. I could mention the inflation, which was gradually getting ever more heavily felt by me because of the expenses of my growing family. I could also mention the racial tensions, which broke out in serious riots during the last several summers right near my home on the west side of Chicago. But to tell you the truth, the thing that made me most afraid, most downcast, was the unwillingness of my friends in Chicago, people whom I knew very well, the people next door, in fact, who refused to recognize that there were problems. For example, I know many people who, in the same breath, will say that they have never smelled or never seen the air pollution, and will also go on to say that they take pride in not seeing it or smelling it. In plain language, there's an underlying attitude, an unwillingness to face problems, which to me seem to indicate that the current problems, no matter how bad, would continue to get worse.
Just go out for a breath of air, and you'll be ready for Medicare. The city streets are really quite a thrill. If the hoods don't get you, the monoxide will. Pollution, pollution, you can use the latest toothpaste. And then rinse your mouth with industrial waste.
How far have we come since this satire was recorded in an American nightclub in 1965? If we just look at it or just talk about pollution without doing something about it, then another civilization probably will die from within and not by conquest from without.
This has been Second Sunday. Pollution, how dangerous. Reporter Bill Lindsay. Field reporters Lionel Hudson, Jay Miller, Roy Neal, and Russ Ward. Technical supervisor Harry DeNasso. Director Bob Sprantle. Producer writer Harry Mantell.
NBC Monitor News. Here is Peter Hackis.